Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Pharmacy Interoperability and Emerging Therapeutics Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and we are glad that you can join us. We have two guest presenters joining us today, and I'd like to thank them for participating in this meeting. This task force is open to the public, and your comments are welcome in Zoom chat throughout the meeting or during the public comment period that will be held around 11:50 Eastern Time this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members. So when I call your name, please let us know if you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs. Hans Botendijk.
Good morning.
Ellie Spiro.
Good morning.
Pooja Babra.
Good morning.
Chris Blackley.
Good morning.
Skyla Blend.
Good morning.
David Butler. Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Roger Gavarti.
Good morning.
Adi Gunlapalli.
Good morning.
Tim Gerges. Summer Kalan. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Meg Marshall. Anna McAllister.
Good morning.
Devin McGraw is not able to join us today. Keaton Mehta. Justin Neal is also not able to join us today. Eliel Oliveira.
I'm here. Good morning.
Naresh Sundararajan.
Morning.
Scott Robertson. Alexis Snyder.
Good morning.
Bill Sutherland.
Good morning.
Christian Tadris.
Good morning.
Gerald Turney.
Good morning.
And Afton Wagner.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much. And now please join me in welcoming Hans and Shelley for their opening remarks.
Hans, I think you're first.
Well, good morning, everybody. Appreciate everybody joining us. Shelley, remind us of the 11th. A meeting already. We have a few more to go. Today we are going to look at task three that Shelley is going to introduce in a moment. And then after that, we're going to go back to task one, continue where we picked up. We're going to highlight a few of the updates that were made to make sure we caught them. And then we're going to continue where we left off with the review and go as far as we can. So today is very much about focusing on finalizing as much as possible the recommendations. So we're looking forward to a discussion, clarifications, and in the chat, please continue to make your comments there, thoughts, suggestions that we can then further blend into the spreadsheet. After this week, particularly topic one, we hope that we can close that down, if not to topic two as well, in terms of working on it in the spreadsheet, and then we're going to shift over to a document format. So depending on where we are at the end of this week, we'll begin to edit and finalize in a Google or a Word document to make that a little bit easier. So that's where we're at. Shelley, all yours, and to take us into the first agenda topic.
Well, thank you. I also want to thank Hans and the ONC team for covering for me on the last call. I appreciate it. I was glad things went as well as they can. And thank you, Hans, for going over the agenda. We have two presenters today. Stephanie Garcia from the branch, who is with branch chief at ONC, and also Mark Dunnenberger, Assistant Vice President of Personalized Medicine and Pharmacogenomics, North Shore University Health Systems. To the presenters, we ask that you keep it to 5 minutes, and because we want to have time to make sure that we have questions answered by the task force members. So please welcome to our public attendees. Just to remind you, we will stop at 11:50 for a public comment that Mike will help us with. So if you want to be heard via the voice, you're more than welcome to. Please, those of you who are attendees and also the panelists, please put your comments into the chat. They are captured as part of the public comment, so we encourage you to do that. And with that, I think we will move to Stephanie's presentation. Thank you, Stephanie.
Hello, can you hear me? All right, awesome. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to present during today's task force meeting. My name is Stephanie Garcia, and I am a branch chief within the Networks and Scalability Division of the Office of Technology at ONC. Today, I'm presenting an overview of the Sync for Genes project. Next slide, please. So we'll start with an overview of Sync for Genes, its five phases, and the premise for the work conducted. Then I'll give a brief description of the outcomes and opportunities that resulted from the most recent phase. And lastly, I'll give an overview of the resource guide that was created to capture and present all the information across phases in one place. Next slide. So Sync for Genes launched in 2017 as a collaboration between NIH and ONC to help deliver on the goals of the Precision Medicine Initiative and NIH's All of Us research program. Sync for Genes was meant to be the first step toward integrating clinical genomics into the point of care to support the rise of genomic testing and the improved ability to study genomics and apply those findings to the improvement of health. The Sync for Genes mission was to standardize the sharing of genomic information among laboratories, providers, patients, and researchers. And over the course of five phases, the project advanced the development and use of industry-supported standards for the sharing and integration of genomic information in a consistent and usable way by primarily encouraging the use of HL7-FHIR for genomic data exchange. So on this slide, you can see very top level results from each phase. Oh, I'm sorry, next slide. This slide. And I'll just pause for a brief moment since I was speaking to the previous slide. Next slide, please. So as the work started, we saw everything from interoperability challenges, the need for data partners to create unique interfaces for data exchange, to the complexities that genomics introduces that some standards can't quite support yet, such as the need to share large data files that can be parsed. The ONC understood that cutting edge work like this, work that happens at the intersection of health IT, genomics, science, healthcare, and research is a green field, and that there could be incremental progress made by conducting short-term successive phases, each with small-scale pilot demonstrations or testing. So the project continued and picked up speed, with the goal of each subsequent phase being informed by the previous phase findings and work. By focusing on these key areas, strategic development and adoption of genomic standards, support and coordination for implementers, targeted education and training on the use of standards and solutions, and again, a phased approach to make progress on larger industry challenges, the Sync for Genes project paved the way for work to continue that supports the efficient and effective genomic sharing, ultimately to improve patient care. Next slide, please. So now moving on to phase five. Next slide. So for phase five, Children's Hospital LA and LMU developed a proof of concept for genomic clinical decision support. They successfully demonstrated that an app could retrieve patient genetic test results using the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health, or GA4GH, variant representation specification and the GA4GH annotation specification for results. The results were then delivered to the test provider using HL7-FHIR. The demonstration highlighted the ability of GA4GH specifications to represent genomic data and knowledge, the degree of harmonization between the GA4GH specification and HL7-FHIR, and the use of the emerging technology called operations that makes FHIR APIs more convenient to use. So to learn more about the details of the work, I encourage the task force members to review the phase five final report that is published on healthit.gov. Next slide, please. The outcomes of SyncroGene Phase 5 were informed by a panel and the demonstration project. The recommendations include, first, there are obvious gaps in standards and technology that are needed, but the recommendation was to continue developing or extending existing standards rather than developing new standards. Second, there is a need for standards-based content, such as the description of genomic variations and the annotation data that describes knowledge regarding the effect those variations may have. So while there are knowledge bases that can present information about simple variations in a discrete format, complex variations are more difficult to present in a computable form. Currently, the annotation, such as the description of lab results, are typically presented in unstructured text, making them difficult to use by clinical decision support. Third, it is well known that adoption of standards for genomics is difficult given the needed resources and technical expertise that is needed for implementation, and therefore a finding was suggested to develop a testing environment such as a sandbox that could support implementers before installation and yield best practices to lower barriers to adoption. Fourth, the infrastructure that is needed to support the large volumes of data that result from genomic tests and studies is large, as is the need to support the complexity of genomic data and systems that would provide up-to-date interpretations for genomic variations. Fifth, the use of complex genomic data by providers and patients could be supported by CDS, although robust training is needed. The quality of CDS depends largely on computable knowledge being available. And lastly, as we all know, genomics is a relatively new field, and there is much education needed on several fronts, and standardized representation, exchange, and use of genomic data and knowledge. I know my time is just about up, so I'm going to skip two more slides, please. And I'm just going to quickly highlight one more. There we go. This toolkit that was developed for the SyncroGenes project includes all the resources across the phases. I've highlighted core resources here that were most critical to success of the project. And last slide, please. Thank you.
You're on mute.
On mute, yes. Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate you sticking to time. We did start just a few minutes early, so I did give you another minute. Next, we are going to hear from Mark. So Mark, you're on for 5 minutes, please.
All right. Well, thanks for the invitation to speak. Having the pleasure of speaking about pharmacogenomics. If we can go to the next slide. So my comments are limited to germline pharmacogenomics, so not talking about somatic or tumor or cancer genetics, but specifically about germline pharmacogenomics. And in germline pharmacogenomics, there's an interpretation process that needs to occur. Whether this happens at the bedside or happens in the laboratory, there are multiple levels of information that need to be communicated to impact clinical care. So the first two, haplotype, diplotype, these are laboratory-based values. A phenotype is something that's easily described, so CYP2D6-4 metabolizer, and then a therapeutic recommendation, being what do you need to do when you have this genetic result paired with a drug. There are international organizations that create therapeutic recommendations, such as CPIC, the Clinical Pharmacogenomics Implementation Consortium. Those are widely available via APIs, so we're good there. For phenotypes, CPIC has went through and standardized the nomenclature for pharmacokinetic-related genetic variants, but not pharmacodynamics. There's not a lot of information in that space, but that's going to be a problem headed into the future. These phenotypes are supported by LOINC codes, so they can be communicated pretty easily. One major problem we have here is there's not agreement, though. Not all labs use these standards for the translation from diplotype to phenotype. And so that creates a problem where, as a clinician, I need to know the diplotype information that was used to derive the phenotype because I may disagree with that. So for diplotypes in pharmacogenomics, we use this thing called star alleles. And you can see it represented on this page, star one, or star one, star two, et cetera. So we'll go to the next slide. I'll tell you the secret about star alleles. Okay, so star alleles. Star one denotes a default reference allele, meaning if I don't find any changes for what I'm looking at, I'm going to call somebody a star one or call an allele a star one. All of the other star alleles just represent one or multiple variants in the order that they were found. But because star one is a diagnosis of exclusion, I need to know the metadata around the test to be able to make sense of that star one. Because I could test the same person at multiple labs, and if they tested different variants, I will get different calls. The patient could be a star one at one lab and a star 47 at another, but actually both of them are correct based off of their test. We do not have good standards for communicating this metadata. This becomes important because typically a star one is a normal metabolizer. And if the patient had a variant that wasn't interrogated, but maybe had low function, they could be a poor metabolizer, and I'm going to make an incorrect therapeutic recommendation for that patient. We'll go to the next slide. We can advance all the way through the slide so I can show you. One other problem I have is there are a lot of ways that a lab could report out the same information. So we integrate with five different labs in my institution, and for one pharmacogenomic result, CYP2D6 star 1 star 10, I have it described 25 different ways in my medical record. I need all 25 of these to match up and mean the same thing. I have the time and resources to do this, but an average health system and an average HIT department isn't going to have the time and energy to aggregate this. There are thousands of combinations for CYP2D6, and this is just one combination I'm seeing 25 different times. So having some standards around how things have to be reported would be huge, and having those adopted. If we'll go to the next slide. And finally, the last thing that needs to be conquered is better communication between health systems and pharmacies. We need to use these genetic results in a number of different places. And the genetics may come from non-pharmacogenomic testing, other disease testing happening in the health system. How do we get that to the community pharmacies? Nobody's solved this yet. One of the big issues here isn't a standards issue, but a value proposition issue that the field has to solve. And with that, I will stop and I'll give Shelley back 15 seconds.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Mark, that was great, and we appreciate you. We have 2 minutes extra, so that gives us, we will be having a discussion until 10 minutes after the hour, so we've got 32 minutes for discussion. And Pooja, I think you're up first.
Yeah, so thank you to the speakers. This was great information. I guess my question or comment, I think, it's exciting to see the, especially the sync for genes, but I wonder from a pharmacy perspective, I'm thinking kind of the PGX, right, is very relevant for having that information within the pharmacy workflow. I know NCPDP has just recently put out a white paper, which I put into the chat, about kind of how we should be thinking about potentially standardizing some of the information that's coming back from the lab and make it accessible to pharmacies. So just wanted to point that out. I think it's definitely worth the task group or task force members kind of looking at that as well as we start to think about recommendations.
Thank you, Pooja. Anyone else? Christian.
Thanks, Shelley. Maybe just a question on where this standardization, I mean, the comment about the different labs reporting different, even the same result in different ways and that standardization process, I certainly agree that needs to happen because, you know, we need a universal translator scenario, but where would that best occur? Is that something that, needs to be addressed through a multiple kind of SDO working group? It seems like that's got a lot of clinical subject matter expertise from the guidance entities, but also this probably, and I'll call ourselves kind of lightweights at that aspect of standardization of that data in the exchange process for information exchange and interpretation from these IT systems. How do you put that together? So where would all this apply, I guess, is the question. Where could that work be done?
So is that to Stephanie or to Mark, Christian?
Yeah, maybe just a suggestion from Mark. I mean, how do you see that playing out? It seems like that's going to have to, that's a huge group of labs and clinicians and guidance entities to have to even pull together to try to standardize that. What does that look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the short answer is a number of stakeholders going to AMP or some other laboratory reporting organization and either collaborating with them to come up with the standards for how we should do that or expressing a strong need for this to happen to have better adoption of genetic testing. I don't, because of the way lab reports work, I don't think it's something that the pharmacy group or a pharmacy group could put out a standard for it. I think they need to be stakeholders in the use of a standard.
So a follow-up on that, I guess to Stephanie, in your slide deck, you talked about this type of standardization. Do you have any comments on some of the issues that that Mark had brought up?
Yeah, so I think the clinical standardization, so how the representation of the actual results would best be left to a body that has a majority of clinicians represented. I could speak mostly to the standards development organization point perspective. And really at that point, it's just a matter of being able to transport the information in a standardized way. So we were able to successfully demonstrate in HL7 Connectathon the ability to parse out different parts of the genetic test report and then demonstrate how to send that using FHIR and also demonstrating not just the simple report format, but basically like embedded test results within the report. But as far as the standardization of the actual like annotation or the clinical, interpretation of the results, I unfortunately can't speak on that front.
Thank you, Stephanie. Alexis? I'm sorry, Anna. Alexis. Anna.
Well, we both start with an A.
I know. I have that problem. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I'm the youngest of five kids. I'm used to answering to everything. So I, at the risk of seeming dense, I guess part of my question is, do we need to get this, do we need to make it this complicated? I mean, and I understand genomics a bit. I understand pharmacogenomics. I understand a bit about data. Data standardization, I realize that all of this is incredibly complex. But when I think about, you know, somebody who takes, I don't know, I think the current count is 14 different medications, some of which do have pharmacogenomic, for which pharmacogenomics is important. I've had two different PGX tests, which have been helpful. But when I look at that, I mean, it's difficult to understand because nobody really talks about it, but you know, when you look at the report, it says, you know, CYP2D6, poor metabolizer, rapid metabolizer, whatever. That seemed like a relatively straightforward call. If you could just put those two fields into a standardized format. I mean, again, I don't understand enough about the complexities to get into star one versus star two and how one person could be both a star one and a star 42. So I am sure that there's a lot that is completely going over my head and I probably seems simpler to me than it actually is. But I'm wondering if we really need that level of complexity within the data or if the data or the information that comes through in the report about the specific gene and whether or not you're fast, slow, or rapid normal metabolizer, then wouldn't that be sufficient?
So I would love for it to be sufficient, but the problem is there. So you could give that information as long as you also gave me the method that you use to translate the actual laboratory result into that phenotype call. Because there is disagreement on, and commercial labs do this, will report some diplotypes into either ultra rapid if you go to lab A and to normal metabolizer if you go to lab B. And so because I can't trust that label and I don't know how you got there, I need to understand the diplotype underneath it and what was tested to come up with that diplotype, because you start to get big differences in based on a patient's race and ethnicity as to which variants you may see or may not see. And if your test does not cover the variants seen in their population, you're going to erroneously give me a laboratory result that says they're a star one, when in, and I'll translate to a normal metabolizer, when in fact they're going to be something else, maybe a star 41, which will make them a poor metabolizer for a given gene. So you have two different problems. One is there's not agreement amongst all labs to use the same translation from the raw laboratory result to a phenotype. Therefore, I want to know the raw laboratory result, and to know the raw laboratory result and to make sense of it, because we use a diagnosis exclusion to assign the most common star allele, I need to know the metadata behind it. It's just the complexity of what's going on there. I wish you could just take a phenotype and move forward, but that's not where we're at today.
So it just sounds like we haven't really, I mean, I guess if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, it kind of gets into not really polygenic risk scores, but sort of polygenic pharmacogenomic scores.
I mean, still thinking about one gene. And I caution you to say that we just don't know enough today, because what we know today are the low-hanging fruits where big bins of phenotypes work. Where we're headed in the future is going to be genotype substrate specific recommendations, where you're not always the same phenotype for a given enzyme across any substrate. You're going to have individual substrates or different drugs where you'll be a normal metabolizer for one and a poor metabolizer for the other, as you think about the protein changes inside of the enzyme based on the genetic variation. It is only going to get more complicated in the future. Right now, we're at the easy part of pharmacogenomics.
Thank you. David.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to probably pack a lot into this history, among other things, into this premise before asking the question. But my premise is the fact that most of the clinical trials that have been done historically have been on populations that were assumed to be homogeneous. But as we know, those were just bell-shaped curves with a couple of standard deviations, and the drug therapy was said to work in that population or not. We know now clearly that we can become much more personal identifying each drug to the gene that would be applicable with regard to the dosing, the adverse effects, potential types of allergies and such like that. But if we do develop all of this nomenclature, it seems that so that we do get the stars worked out, then the stars aligned, if you forgive me, then we will end up with a set of data from the clinical trials historically that is still very vague and nebulous. And if you look at and having worked on some of the groups dealing with adverse effects and worried about the fact that every one of our hospitals and every one of our community practitioners still asks the patient only, do you have allergies? Not do you have you ever had an adverse event? That we don't really have all of the data, and we don't have a standard set for the clinical impact of drugs being used on a particular gene. So I'm concerned that we may end up with an appropriate standardization on the genes, but we have nothing to tie it to on which drug within a drug class is the one that's actually going to affect that specific patient. Do you see, as this develops, and to my question, do you see that as we improve the gene standardization and the specification per patient with the impact of the drug, that we can further refine the drug adverse event standardization, and that will lead us to improving the data capture when patients are admitted to the hospital or seen by a physician, so that the pharmacist will know to monitor for when this patient comes in, this specific adverse event that may occur with a drug, or the drug interaction that may occur, or is the dose right, or all the things that we'll be able to do. So how do you, I'm afraid we're going to get to a wonderful standardization structure, and then the other half of what's needed is still not going to be there. Could you comment on that, or is, maybe that's just something for the group discussion? I don't know.
I can make a couple of quick comments on that front. And so one is pharmacogenomics is not a panacea for getting rid of drug adverse drug effects, right? Knowing somebody's genetics isn't going to solve all of the problems that are out there. There are a number of other omic things that we have to deal with. And then you have the whole environment as well, right? The microbiome plays a huge role in what your drug exposures are going to be. So what we know today, again, is the easily identifiable stuff where big sections of that bell curve have the genotypes and phenotypes that we care about and have been exposed to the drugs, and we can see them. We know going forward that if we can test more people for genetics and use that data more and have it embedded in the record, if you parallel that with what I think you really want, which is better standardized reporting of adverse drug events, if you take a better genomic data set and a better adverse drug data set, you can begin to do new discovery work and really drive understanding of how genetics affect drug response. But you need both of them together. I think it's actually going to be easier to do the standardization on the genetic side than the adverse drug event side. But both of them together would be a very powerful tool.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Stephanie or Matthew, do you have any comments that you'd like to make on what David brought up? Okay, Scott.
Yes, hi. I'm sort of building on David and Mark's discussion just now and a comment that Christian put in the chat. I'm sort of looking at how to go about addressing this. I don't know if there's an organization that might take on the responsibility of building something like similar to LOINC, where it's sort of built for the idea that things can change. So there's multiple axes that it tracks in terms of, yes, you can describe the sequence, but also the variation, but also you need to know potentially the methodology used or the nature of the descriptor. That could be, if there was an organization that could take on that kind of responsibility, or an organization like that could be developed, that would seem to be a good way to start moving forward toward something that is, you know, that could be recognized across the board. The compendia could work against it. It could tie into clinical decision support. So making that into a question for you, Mark, do you know of anybody or any groups presently that are either looking into such ideas or might be that should be either included or consulted in terms of that type of standardization of the tests?
Yeah, I'll make a couple of quick comments. Somebody in the chat commented, wouldn't CPIC do that? I do not believe that is in the purview of CPIC to solve that problem. So one major challenge that we have now is the value proposition for pharmacogenomics as it stands today in a population approach is not great enough to create resources and standards and organizations on its own. It's just not how medicine works today. It's not how we've set out the value propositions for pharmacogenomics. You can't find it in the literature. So what pharmacogenomics is really focused on is how do we use existing frameworks? And all of the problems you described, Scott, are problems for genetics in general, which is why I was able to work with Sync for Genes on one of the phases, thinking just broadly about genomic data, right? And then putting pharmacogenomics in there as a use case. It's a slightly different use case, but that's where pharmacogenomics is going to be successful, is when we can work with other genomic standards. And there are groups working on that today, thinking about ClinGen and other groups like that. But we have a long way to go.
Yeah, it wouldn't be very useful if pharmacogenomics ended up using a different, potentially incompatible to the rest of the genomics work. So, thank you. That's good.
Thank you. And just to Hans and Jim, we have 3 minutes left. So go ahead, Hans.
Thank you, Sherry, and thank you, Martin, Stephanie, Matthew, for the discussion and presentation so far. The impression that I'm getting, and I'm going to put it a little bit stronger, perhaps, than it's intended, purposefully, to see what kind of recommendations we could make. I'm understanding that a lot of progress is being made, has been made, and yet still needs to be made before we get to a point where we could say, if you look at some of the areas where ONC typically gets involved, certification programs, working with CMS or others to provide incentives to spur adoption, that are capabilities out there that are underutilized and need to have a push, a recognition, or otherwise to move forward. And that's what I'm trying to get a little bit better understanding. Where do you see that beyond the role that ONC currently already has? They are engaged, they are in facilitating roles or participating roles already. But what do you see at this stage of the progression where an ONC in collaboration with other agencies perhaps could help advance, remove a bottleneck that is currently in place? Or do we see is that, no, it's still very much the community, the clinical community, the environment, the standards community to build up the toolkit before it's at that point that we can say is that now there is wider adoption opportunity. It's not happening. We need to figure out how ONC and others can help move that along. But what's your thoughts on that in that regard? Where are we at and what can we ask or suggest to ONC to particularly pay attention to?
Yeah. So we're in a world today where Medicare pays for pharmacogenomic testing in most MACs for specific conditions. If this is done correctly, one pharmacogenomic test will have lifetime value for that patient. I currently cannot get through a standard mechanism enough information about that test to ensure that I'm maximizing the value in patient care of those test results. ONC and collaborators need to work on HL7 Firebase standards to communicate that metadata around a test in an efficient process where I can take a test result or a lab report and get a full understanding of what happened so I can maximize the value to the patient.
Thank you. So I'm curious in that context, the work that is happening in a CODEX, in a clinical genomics work group with HL7 and CPDP, is that in need of additional activity by ONC, or is it just helping make sure that it keeps on moving along because it takes time? I understand the need to get to that point. I'm trying to figure out is that where's the gap in what we still need to do to move that along faster or better?
I'll defer to Stephanie.
Stephanie or Matthew?
Yeah, so I would say, hearing your recommendations on how to move projects like Sync for Genes is very valuable in making sure that those programs continue. I can't at this point really speak to what the future of Sync for Genes is at this point. So, yeah.
Okay, I've seen a comment.
Thinking through just one more second, sorry. What I would say is, as I mentioned in the presentation, Sync for Genes is really meant to be kind of the starting, as you might have alluded to, Hans, right? The instigator or the catalyst to work that may not be done. So just additional ideas that are brought to ONC for continued pilot testing and just ways to support the adoption. But we really need to hear those recommendations from this group, I think would be very valuable.
Thank you.
I think Hans, we're 2 minutes over our time into the recommendations. Ike has a question. How do you want to move?
I would say wrap up with Ike, and then we'll go from there.
Sounds good. Ike.
I will make this as quick as I can. I know there's a lot of data volume associated with genetic information. Is there a suggestion about a recommendation that we could make to ONC regarding how volume might be managed so we're not ending up with 22 different copies of the same data across 22 different pharmacies or other providers? That just seems to be an awful lot of unnecessary duplicative storage and transmission. Is there something we can do to recommend a more efficient way of storing that data, but still making it accessible to those who need it?
So in clinical practice today, by the time the data gets to a healthcare system, it is not a lot of data points. It's, if you wanted to visualize it, it's maybe 30 rows and 6 columns in an Excel spreadsheet would give you enough to be able to describe what you need. In the genomic space writ large, yes, it's huge data. But by the time that gets out of the laboratory, it's been distilled down enough that big data today is not a problem. I could imagine some point in the future it might be, but that's a problem bigger than pharmacogenomics alone.
But so would it be, just as a quick follow-up, would it be fair to say a good recommendation might include the exchange of data, exchange of genomic data, critical for clinical decision-making and kind of sidestepping that you necessarily need the entire stack of all the background data?
Yeah, I would include that in your recommendations as to the scope that you're referring to.
Thank you.
Okay, Hans, I'll turn it back over to you now to go over the recommendations and if we can pull up the spreadsheet.
All right, so thank you, Mark and Stephanie, for the discussions, and we'll then move into the next topic. I really appreciate that. And if throughout the conversations in the chat, there's additional thoughts on particular recommendations, please put them in there as well that we can pick them up. So that means is that we're gonna go back to the spreadsheets. We're gonna go to topic one. We're gonna look at mostly, if we can, columns D, E, and F on the screen as best as possible. You may need to open up your local copy, but primarily we'll look at D and E, and F will use for some comments that we make along the way to make sure that we are capturing some thoughts. A little recap of what happened since last week and what you see right now. You will see in column E that that all the I noticed that the column header disappeared for the final recommendation. We'll fix that. But we marked all the recommendations as R1 through on this page. We're now up to 23. We got as far last week, R1 through R9. There were a couple of areas that we needed to make sure that they were included and that we had follow-ups on. So when you look at the first cell in E2, actually, if you can jump back to E2, that would be great. There are two particular follow-ups. One, we have a question for Ike to look at R2 to see whether any additional refinements are to be made. And in R3, Alexis, the comments that you made that we had a little challenge to find and then found them, you made some additional or an additional update to that same one. Want to make sure is that the comment in R3 where we merged the three bullets into two, that we captured the consent aspect and the disclosure aspect sufficiently. So if you can specifically look at that, and then generally, if everybody can look through, we're not going to run through it today, but if you can run through and make sure that with the additional updates, whether you have any further thoughts on the refinement at this point. When we look at the next row, 3, is what you see is that Anna had the opportunity to put a number of different comments in that we have not reviewed together. They are now marked as R10 through R14 in this regard. The red is to clarify where there are differences from what Anna's put into the draft recommendation, and as it's being put in the draft final recommendation, to have some suggestions for adjustments there. They look substantial, but they are actually trying to condense some of the information and trying to make sure that that captured it. So Anna, particularly here from your perspective, I want to see that we make sure that in the process didn't lose anything there. We're going to come back to R10 through 14 in a moment, because that's where we want to pick it up and run through with everybody to see whether there is general agreement that they are recommendations we want to move forward and finalize, or whether there are some that we need to have further discussion around. So in a moment, we're going to go come back to R10. And then in the next row, rows 4 through, and that should be 5. Yes, is where the remainder of the recommendations that we talked about last week, where the further additions have been made or clarifications. So the question there is that, did we catch that? Did we miss anything? And particularly in E5 for Ike, a question, whether the updated recommendation addressed the concerns that you originally raised and that we didn't miss that. So those are the particular updates since last week. So have a look at those as soon as you can, and so that we can round that out. And then today we're going to pick it up with R10 in a couple of rows back, and then we'll pick it up with row 6 again with the rest. Before jumping though into that, is there any general comments before we jump in?
Now, Anna, you have a comment?
I just want to make sure that I'm following correctly. So you took a look at my recommendations, and I want to know what it is I need to do to make sure that.
So in the, for example, particularly in one, in the first two that are now in the column E are R10 and R11.
Okay.
I started with the recommendation that you had for both. But then as I was going through, I was trying to streamline a little bit more put them in the context of our overall recommendations. So particularly the R10 and R11, did anything get lost in the recommendation that you were trying to make?
Okay. I'm
trying to streamline it a little bit. I might have gone too far with that and want to make sure I didn't. So anything that you have there, absolutely welcome.
Okay, I'll take a look. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I think, if I can, Hans, I think it's important that everybody realize what we're trying to do is we have comments in the different topics, and what we're trying to do is harmonize those into recommendations, not necessarily by topic, but they're sort of the topics that we, especially in public comments, a lot of the top and a lot of those top topics are duplicate in the other topics. And that's what Hans has done a great job in trying to consolidate them into recommendations that we can move together, because we know that there is some cross-pollination between the different recommendations in the different topics, if that makes sense. Hans,
ahead. And additionally, is that in this particular context, is that I was trying to transform some of the personal perspectives that Anna, that you brought to that, into a more neutral perspective of overall to a representative from a task force perspective. So that's what I tried to, particularly number one, you will see the words I change into describing it differently and without trying to change the intent behind that. So that's why there's a little bit more changes there. Other ones that I didn't do that because that wasn't there.
Makes perfect sense. So I'm guessing you took out the emojis.
Well, I was trying to stay a little bit emoji free there. All right. So let's start with that. So the first one is that, and R10 through R14 again, they're all from Anna. First one is recommend that ONC require any informational elements that is involved in determining which drugs get covered with or without a prior authorization and what cost is captured and accessible to pharmacies, pharmacists, other providers, and patients. So that it is require any informational element that is involved in determining that it's... that it is captured and accessible to pharmacists, and other providers, and then provides a rationale behind that. And that was clearly part of our conversation that we want to find ways that such data can become available as a standard course of matter. I think we need to just do a little bit more tweaking maybe, but any comments, questions, any concerns with carrying this forward? Other than fine-tuning and clarifying, perhaps.
I'm happy to give clarifying or provide some of the rationale if that would be helpful. I don't want to just...
No. This would be not specific to public health, but general for pharmacy, pharmacists, provider. Is that accurate, Anna?
Yeah. And this is really driven by a frustration I shared previously about, a health plan required a specific, only one specific NCD code could be covered, but nobody involved in any of the decision-making process knew anything about that, including my physician, the pharmacies, the PBM. Only the health plan was sort of discovered accidentally that was the secret sauce as to why I suddenly need a prior authorization for a medication I've taken for like 20 years. So.
Okay, so I'll make that note for just for our here at the end that we need to make sure that it's not tagged as specific to public health, but across the board. Mark is not specific.
Pooja?
Yeah, I definitely like this recommendation. I'm trying to figure out how to make it so it's a little more clear. So today, in the e-prescribing workflow and in EHR, if the drug is covered under the pharmacy benefit, there is information that's flowing, right? That's through the formulary and benefit file, as well as through the real-time benefit check, where there is a flag that says a prior auth is required for this drug. And then again, through the EHR, the doctor, if the drug is covered under the pharmacy benefit, could do, could electronically ping the PBM. They bring back the questions that the provider would need to answer to get that prior authorization. So I'm just wondering if we need to change this recommendation a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure if we're talking about like certifying that workflow which I think makes sense. And then the other thing is, today a pharmacist could technically do the prior authorization electronically as well, if the health plan allows them to do that. So I'm just trying to understand if there's something within the scope of ONC, you know, do we make this more certification related? Do we expand it for specialty? I'm just struggling a little bit with this, but I do agree that we need to get something around this. And then the final thing I'll say is I think we're confusing prior auth with price transparency, and I wonder if we need to separate them out into two separate recommendations.
But I mean, since this is driven from my personal use case, I mean, so the pharmacist and the doctor, everybody saw that it required a prior authorization. But the reality is it didn't if you had the right NCD code. But nobody knew that except for the health plan until I accidentally discovered it. And again, this was a medication that I did. Forever, suddenly it was like, you know, one of my surprise prior auths. So the health plan had made a decision that they just hadn't communicated. And this is a very, you know, NCD codes are structured, understood, exchange. I mean, like that would be a very simple piece of information to provide. Mm-hmm. So I didn't specifically list NCD code. Maybe that would be a solution, because to me, it felt like a very arbitrary thing. And rather than speaking to one specific arbitrary thing that happened to impact me, just stating that if there is some sort of a decision filter, that data about whatever that decision filter is has to be communicated. So I have no doubt that this is not particularly clearly articulated, but I wasn't quite sure how to do that without being too prescriptive in such a way that would still make it possible for there to be relevant data that isn't shared, if that makes any sense.
Maybe Pooja, if you might have some suggestions for updates, and then with Anna, to see whether that balances the two perspectives there.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
And Hans, we also we need to make sure that because we're putting recommendations in public health, we need to make sure this might not necessarily be a public health.
Agree. So that when we put it in the final, we would not point back to this particular topic. We would point to the general topic that's at hand.
Great. Thank you.
Just looking at the time, we have a bunch to go through. So I want to make sure that we primarily focus on the questions of, are we generally in sync that we need to move forward with the recommendations, or do we believe that it falls outside? And then we can have some offline refinement as well. And sounds like for this one, we would like to move forward with it, but it needs to be further updated to clarify and provide context, maybe split in two. And there is, I also put in a clarification there that some questions might come up with real-time benefits, prescription benefits. Is that what's the right time? Is this doing anything additive to that we can highlight as well? Or is this more advancing what we have? Scott and then Ike.
Well, I'm going to be short because they're going to revise this. I just would recommend, I see this as being focused on the payer or PBM being required to provide this information. When I first read it, I was thinking that everybody has to be able to have access to the appropriate information, and maybe just make sure it gets focused when you do the rewrite. And that's, I'll just leave it there.
Okay.
For time.
Thank you. Ike.
In the same direction, I think the purpose is great. I think the language around the recommendation might be updated a little bit, because requiring any informational element involved in determining which drugs are covered without a prior authorization is not really what we're asking. But I think we're asking is that the PBMs provide any of the information necessary if a prior authorization is required, be submitted electronically, if that makes any sense. So,
would that resonate with you? That will clarify better the direction for this recommendation.
Yeah, I think so. I need to look at the language a little bit, but yeah.
I think the focus of the recommendation is on whether a drug needs prior authorization or not, and if so, what information is required communicated from the PBM to the pharmacists and the provider, not the determination of whether a drug is prior auth or not by the PBM itself. In other words, that's more of an upstream decision than, hey, this drug is prior auth, here's what you need. This drug is not prior auth, you don't need.
Yeah, in this case, the PBM didn't even have the information. It was just right.
All right, so do you then want to look at when Pooja and Anna have an update to double check that that fits better?
I'm happy to do so.
Okay, then I'll have three names behind this to further clarify. And that's Anna, Pooja, and Ike. Okay. Next one. R11, recommend that ONC work with CMS and other relevant agencies to develop an incentive structure so that prescribing providers and patients can be accurately informed at the point of care whether a prescribed recommended medication intervention is available at the pharmacy to which the patient medication has been sent referred. This should include data on the status of drug supplies, medication availability, and detailed tracking data on shipments for medication with all actors in process, including pharmacies, ordering providers, patients, and public health emergency systems. We suggest that a cross-sectional workshop with a focus on the patient and ordering providers go through a use case model to further inform the necessary capabilities and gaps.
Well, Anna, maybe we should use your use case.
I'm happy to. I mean, I have several use cases for that one.
It might be helpful to write them up so that we can use them.
Well, I think they're in there somewhere. I mean, I provided the rationale and the copy that I wrote as well. So I put it some of the use case, but I mean.
So two questions there then is that. Anna, did that reflect the second recommendation sufficiently in the way that adjusted that, or does that miss anything there?
I'll have to go through and read it again. I think you got it. I mean, I don't remember recommending a task force, but that seemed like a reasonable approach if that's necessary. It seems to me like, I mean, all of the data around inventory is already there, it's just in other systems, and I think it should be incorporated into, you know, the system that is available. You know, if UPS can have the tracking information, or if, you know, the distributor has information about their inventory and shipping, etc., then why not make that data available?
Yeah, there was an additional comment that triggered inclusion of that that note on a workshop, so that's where it came from one of the discussion notes.
Okay.
Anybody have questions, Christian?
Yeah, on this topic of inventory visibility, you know, we have that example in the public health scenario with regard to public access of availability of the vaccinations of COVID-19. I can speak from experience, it's an incredibly burdensome system to do and manage on a daily basis, especially, and that was just trying to keep it within real time being defined as around 24 hours. Inventory levels in any given part of the supply chain vary from minute to minute to hours. And even, it's just an incredibly complex request, even if it's well-intentioned. So I have some heartburn over this as a broad expectation. I think there are some use cases that where it may make sense that are driven by urgency and means that are not just raw inventory numbers because of the risk of misinterpretation and the high likelihood of it devolving into a steerage scenario, which I don't think is appropriate. This is really one of those things where it's always it just depends. And I don't know that we can, I don't envision an environment in the near term for sure, and maybe even not in the long term, given the pressures on the supply chain, some of the economics around that are impacting real-time inventory levels and long-term storage of stuff, that this doesn't become problematic and misinforming in nature. So that's my ultimate concern with this recommendation, not that the intention of, you know, reducing time to delivery. I just would think that we need to really dial this down into when timeliness of medication in hand is urgent. That should be where that comes from, ultimately.
Thank you, Christian. And on that part, I'd like to ask if you can make some review that further and make some suggestions on how to adjust the wording to better reflect that, to strike that balance where we can. That would be great. And going to go to Afton, and we might have a couple of additional follow-ups on this recommendation to be made. But Afton, go ahead.
Thanks, Christian, whatever, well, Christian just said, I don't want to reiterate all of it, but when you've seen inventory in 1 minute, it could change to the very next. And so agree with everything. And he just hit the nail on the head with what I was thinking. Could we focus this more on acute situations where patients immediately need medications and then maybe try to broaden out if we can, but it's just, it'd be very difficult to know the inventory that day. Things change from minute to minute, hour to hour. So let's take a look at this a little bit closely and figure out what's doable and what might not be as much. I'd hate to send a patient to a pharmacy saying that it's available and that it was just dispensed or it was on hold for somebody else. And that could cause more confusion, especially if at the point of prescribing, they're told that it would be there. We see that a lot already. At the start of e-prescribing, I remember when I was still a student, it was still new and I would, you know, the patient's like, oh, well, it was just e-prescribed and either the medication wasn't there at the pharmacy and it would add to a lot of confusion. So I just want to try to avoid that.
Thank you. Hannah.
Just to push back on some of those points, and again, I am not speaking about this with any degree of expertise about like how inventory reporting systems work, but I do know that I interact a lot with Amazon and they seem to have a pretty accurate ability to understand where things are, as do other online retailers and shoppers. They can get shopping environments, including Amazon's pharmacy. About where things are, when it's being shipped, how much the inventory is, et cetera. So that is something that can happen in certain circumstances. If there are reasons why that can't happen in a more distributed model with more, with different actors, different companies involved, that might be something to explore. But it's not just an issue of urgency for a specific med, it's what is the workload? And again, as I've said before, take 14 different meds, use 3 different medical devices, but I have to manage all of that inventory and I have to keep on top of it. And PBMs are now restricting access to supply until you're pretty much almost out of it. So any change, any supply shortage, anything, if a pharmacy says they ordered it and it'll be in tomorrow and it doesn't come in that day or the next day or the next day, all of the burden for tracking that down and trying to find out where things are falls on me. And again, if you multiply that times 14 plus 3 medical devices, that's a lot of time and effort. And I can do this, somebody like my mother cannot. So it's not just an issue of urgency, it's an issue of burden. And this is really about identifying and coming up with what are the informational elements that could reduce the burden to make it possible for individuals to stay healthy and to avoid getting sick.
Can I ask that Richard, Afton, and Anna, that you three, perhaps maybe Alexis as well, depending on the next comment, could follow up offline between now and next meeting to see whether there's a language that can provide the balance between the two, the need of timely information in certain circumstances, balancing with some of the questions that Richard and Afton are raising. we should be able to get together as a small group to address that.
Sure. Can you just say who that was?
That would be you, Afton, Richard, and depending on the comment that that Alexis may make as well.
Was it Christian? I think it was Christian.
It was Christian. Sorry, my bad.
Yeah, I'm being voluntold to step up. I'll do it.
Okay.
Still have our fix to finish, but I'll do that too.
It's only one more. Alexis.
Yeah, I think Anna made my point at the end when she talked about burden. And so, of course, I'm all for avoiding patient confusion, but also lowering burden. And I think I had brought this up with use case that's also embedded somewhere in the document at this point as well, that I think this also leads us back to kind of the point I have made in the past about somebody championing this whole process through from beginning to end, and whether that's a pharmacist taking that lead or someone, the provider, and taking that lead to reduce patient burden, because it's not just point of inventory in a retail pharmacy, it's also supply. And when there's not supply and you can't get it anywhere locally, then the burden is to get a new prescription, to make sure decision-making about maybe a different prescription, a different dose, who has what dose available at what pharmacy and when. And that all takes hours and hours and hours of time, which we all know then leads to poor outcomes when patients aren't taking their medication. And so I'm also happy to be included in that small group offline, as you mentioned.
Great, thank you. Yeah, if somebody then can take the lead in pulling that together, reaching out to do that, that would be great, email or otherwise.
Can I respond or ask Alexis a question? Alexis, are you in, and Anna too, do you have a case manager on your beneficiary side, on your health plan side, that helps coordinate any of this?
They're useless.
They're useless. Okay, thank you.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so, I mean, some of the use case I'm referring to is for myself, and in that case, no. But my daughter, who is a complex patient, takes multiple medications, has about 14 physicians, does have a complex care program and complex care physician that she works with, but this is not something that they take the lead on.
Interesting. Thank you. I'm sorry, Jim.
Jim, you're next, and then we're going to go on to R12.
Yeah, I just wanted to support the recent comments about inventory and not just, you know, and I don't mean to state it roughly, but not just avoid it because it's hard. You know, in the hospital space, I understand, you know, supply, non-med supplies are difficult with PAR levels, et cetera. But, you know, just focusing on emergent use seems wrong to me. It, you know, like people have said, Amazon and others have figured it out. From my perspective, starting with understanding what inventory and then educating the patients about how that changes, I would not support avoiding it right now.
Thank you. All right, we'll move on. And regarding the general comment on the emergent versus public health versus normal operations, a number of these, like the prior one, as we are moving them into the document, we're going to make sure is that they are reflective of more general purpose, or very specifically, and this one looks also like a general topic, not only emergent, but let's see how the subgroup is going to further refine that recommendation. Okay, let's look at the next one. Recommend that ONC require any intent to change a health plan's drug formulary that should be declared ahead of time, with that information being shared with the patient, pharmacist, and the provider. This might get challenging because I'm not sure whether that is in the purview of ONC, what it can do. So I think here we need to think a little bit about what is really the intent, what could ONC do? Is this something that they can work with somebody else, or is it out of scope of what we can achieve in this task force? Not to say this is not a challenge and a need, but this might be on the edge of, if not beyond the edge of our scope. So Anna, if you can clarify a little bit more, that will be great.
Is that R12? Is that your
R12 is what we're looking at?
This frankly maybe outside of OSC's jurisdiction. So one of the things that is a constant frustration for me is that formularies change. They just sort of surprise, and all of a sudden a drug that you've taken forever gets voted off the formulary. And then even though you're almost out of it, you have no notification to actually get prior authorization ahead of time. So then you have to begin the process of prior authorization and denials and then, you know, appeals, et cetera. Meaning several cases I've had to go months without getting access to medication, because the only way that I can appeal as a patient is to literally write a letter to the health plan. They won't speak to me, or get my physician to do it. You know, in a couple of cases, I mean, I have dossiers of clinical studies that document the benefit of particular medications that I have, you know, submitted and various appeals that I provide to my physician. But there is, all of that stuff can be done. It's absurd that it has to be done, but there's no notification whatsoever that there's an anticipated formulary change. It just happens. And again, because PBMs are now limiting the amount of inventory for each medication that you can have for individuals, you're basically sort of like this just-in-time inventory rationale for medication access. So if that's the case and you're trying to refill your med and suddenly they decided to take it off formulary without any notification, then you're screwed and you're, you know, dealt with.
Can we perhaps use this as one of the use cases for patient engagement as a topic that is part of that general scope, but that's where it's explored, where the priorities, what kind of interoperability requirements should be established rather than having a recommendation in this point. And I see that Tricia Lee's...
Hans, I think you let Tricia Lee comment on this. Go ahead, Tricia Lee.
Thank you. I was trying to get off of mute. Yeah, thank you for bringing this area up. This is out of scope as currently written. There might be ways to redo this, but I really can't give that direction, maybe focusing, you know, on the technical capabilities, but intent to change, that's not a space for ONC, and we don't have any jurisdiction over what policies the health plan or PBMs might have. So just as it's written right now, if there's more work to do or to kind of flesh out where the technical components might be, but right now this R12 is out of scope. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tricia Lee.
Just a reminder, we have 2 minutes, Hans, until public comment.
So unless there may be something to reconsider, but otherwise, then we'll have to drop this one. But Anna, you may have some thoughts on how to rephrase it otherwise.
Hans, that's exactly what I was thinking, this David Butler, just a way to possibly rephrase this. Even the formularies today are not interoperable in the sense that when the PBM is updating a formulary, that information should be viewable by patients before they begin selecting CMS Medicare plans. And therefore, just making formulary updates available at the time of Medicare plan selection at the end of each year is important for that patient to be able to know which plans to choose. So I could see where we need the plan and the coverage to be part of the record for that patient's pharmacy record, so that they could view all of that as possibilities and could even browse and explore so that they could pick the right plans. The one other aspect, and I'm digressing a little bit here, but just to add to this, I could see this being, most PBMs now are moving also toward a device formulary to go with the drugs in the pharmacies. So the insulin pump and the insulin sensor should be part of that same formulary.
So perhaps maybe, David, you might have an opportunity to provide a suggested rephrasing that would bring it possibly in scope.
Okay, thanks.
That would be great. I'll put your name behind that. And otherwise, if that doesn't work, then unfortunately, we'll have to drop this recommendation for now.
I think it's time for public comment, Hans.
Yeah, so looking at the clock, is that let's go there and then we come back with R13, time permitting.
All right, thank you, Hans and Shelley. We're gonna open up our meeting for verbal public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public want to make a comment. Not seeing any hands raised yet, so I'll turn it back to our co-chairs.
All right, thank you. That means that we're going to continue with 13. And in 13, we are stating that, let me go back up there, recommend that ONC require pharmacy apps portals provide specific information about why medication has not been filled. Any thoughts, comments, and any clarifications here?
Sure. So if you go in through a pharmacy portal or through the app, they have these like structured messages. So it'll say medication, refill pending, additional information required, but it doesn't say what additional information is required. Or refill on hold, insurance issue, but it doesn't say what insurance issue. So in order to be able to figure out exactly which problem I need to solve, I have to either go into or speak to a pharmacist. I have waited on hold for 6 hours trying to get through to my pharmacist when I was sick with COVID. The only way that I was able to get the information I needed was to go into the pharmacy, which is not an ideal situation for anybody. And even then I had to wait in line. So when you go into the pharmacy, after you get one of these cryptic messages, they have some sort of a thing in their interface that has the very specific issue that is at hand. And they print out a piece of paper that tells you exactly what that is. So that data exists, it's in a structured way. It's already in their thing. So why does it not share with me? So I could at least know which problem it is I have to solve and begin solving it rather than waiting on hold for hours or going into the pharmacy to be able to get that information.
And so maybe perhaps this is one that we want to combine, that as ONC is considering certification approach, that this will be one of the kind of capabilities that should be included in that consideration as what PMS is in their engagement with patients should provide. Is that a reasonable place to consider merging this with that topic?
In terms of patient engagement, I don't, what do you mean?
Right now we have a general recommendation that ONC is advancing an approach, certification approach for pharmacy management systems with proper funding and incentives, et cetera. And we enumerate a number of different use cases by including this as one of the aspects of patient engagement where the patient is informed about this type of information, that it would be could be picked up there rather than a separate recommendation.
I'm not opposed to that necessarily, although I wouldn't necessarily consider this patient engagement. It would seem to me to be around, actual what's needed to actually get the medication to the patient, as opposed to the patient engaging. It's what do I have to be able to get my medication? The pharmacy, its data exists, it's already structured, they have it in their system. Why is that not shared with me so that I have the information I need to take the action I have to stay healthy?
Yeah, and maybe to use that more generally in the pharmacy patient interactions, of which there are a number of different ones. Any other comments, Scott? Go ahead. Scott, you have your hand up. If not, you dropped your hand, okay?
Oh, no, sorry, couldn't get to the mute button. Part of the pharmacies would be limited to pass passing along the information they're accepted. I mean, I can see an insurance issue could be a wide range of things, but some of them are rather arcane responses that may not be a whole lot better. Although if it points to something the patient can deal with, then that's really very useful. Frankly, especially in your pharmacy with the 6-hour wait, that is just, I'm saying unbelievable in the situation, not unbelievable that you experienced it. I do believe you experienced it. Just my point to the fact, you know, nobody's actually done the due diligence of following up on it. That's really kind of crazy. But it's just that unless the pharmacies receive more specific information, they can't provide anything more than they receive.
But they should provide the specific information that they have.
I think that they should provide more, something more specific than an insurance issue. Yeah, they probably have something more specific. It may not be terribly helpful because it's not always very helpful to the pharmacy, but the more you know, the more you know about the situation, and I can agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to also state that, you know, many times pharmacies are put in the middle. They are not the payer, and they are not the prescriber. And so they do try to do the coordination as best as possible. But again, because of the lack of interoperable exchange with the payer and the provider in some cases, that it becomes difficult, and the pharmacists are usually stuck in the middle on trying to help the patient, but they too don't have the right information that's available. So just want to make that statement. And I think, Alexis, we have 3 more minutes.
Yeah, we'd like to see whether we can get through R14 and 14 from Vattenbola. They are in the similar kind of space.
Yeah, it can wait. We can move forward.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other concerns with this? Generally, we might discuss placement. Any concerns with this R13 recommendation to move forward? And clarify beyond that, do we hear any concerns there? If not, then the last one, R14, recommend that ONC require pharmacy apps portals to facilitate two-way communication between pharmacy and the patient. This might also be another one of, as we talk about certification approach, a variety of different topics to prioritize, that this would be an example of a capability that would substantially benefit the interaction between the pharmacist and the patient. Hannah, would you be okay if we put it in that context rather than a separate dedicated recommendation, if we can?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, any other comments? I see, Stephen, you have your hand up.
Yeah, Hans, I mean, I think, you know, we've had many discussions about, you know, pharmacists wanting to be, you know, treated and enabled to function like any other member of the care team. And certainly, as you know, as a PCP, I'm very familiar with bidirectional communications with my patients, right? And I think if pharmacists want to be members of the care, you know, I mean, endocrinologists do that, general surgeons do that. I mean, if the pharmacists are going to be members of the care team, it does make sense that they also would support that bidirectional communication, allowing patients to reach out to them with questions and get answers. So I like this recommendation, regardless of how we contextualize it.
Thank you. Yeah, and in general, that's going to be around topics of where you have information available, the ability to then share. You may not have it, and there's nothing to share, but where you have it, how do we address the opportunity to then share it most efficiently with all involved, and all again within proper consent, authority, all those kind of considerations. We are pretty much at the top of the hour within about 0 seconds. So we got through this section. Next time we will pick it up with R15, that is a couple of rows down. So in the meantime, please review, make suggestions like you see in the in red. And for the particular groups that were identified, please take the opportunity to reach out to each other identify an opportunity to enhance and advance the recommendations that that were discussed. So great discussion, great input from everybody. Shelley, last word to you.
Yes, I make a request that the Excel team help facilitate the sort of one-off small group discussions, just from a scheduling perspective, to make it easier for some assistance.
Yeah, they cannot do that because it's not a public meeting.
So I can help facilitate that. Hans and I can help facilitate that, Alexis. Just want to remind everybody, next week, September 27th, we're going to continue on with topic 3 and our recommendations. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day. Sorry we went over a minute, Mike, and Excel team, thank you for all your help.